tweet at TodaySOR.
In these days of surveillance, populism, data theft and algorithms, many people feel a sense of foreboding about the times to come. Paul Mason considers the direction we're taking in a book called Clear, Bright Future. He describes it as a radical defence of the human being. Paul, of course, is a renowned award-winning writer, broadcaster and filmmaker, previously economics editor of Channel 4 News and author of many books. Paul is with me in studio ahead of speaking tonight at the Smock Alley Theatre in Dublin as part of the Dublin Literature Festival. Thanks indeed for coming in.
It's great to be here.
Now, there are several strands to what you're saying in this book. Should we fear for the future, I suppose, is the first general question to you.
Well, look, we're living in... It's 2,500 years since Aristotle and Socrates, 200 years since the steam train. We've got four atom thick silicon chips that can have a trillion switches on them. We've got the greatest human control we've ever had over the world around us. And yet, as you know from observing political events in my country, in the United States, in large parts of the world, we're in chaos. And my optimism about the future is all about gaining control of the technological forces that we've unleashed and trying to bring back people towards some kind of a human-centric politics to make that happen. So, yeah, I am as optimistic as the title of my book is, because I don't think this generation, this young generation, the most educated generation we've ever produced, is going to stand by and let the world spiral into chaos, nationalism, xenophobia and the rest.
I suppose there are several forces at play. One, obviously, being technology, to which you've alluded. The other is ideologies that are there. Now, you, I think, are a product of the 60s, and I know your father was down the pits and your grandfather was down the pits and in the mines. And you write up with affection for the kind of society that followed the war, the Second World War in Britain. There was a kind of a social dimension to life that, it's, you know, you had the National Health Service and you had education was made available to people like yourself. Good times, but the force of economic history changed everything, didn't they?
We can't go back there. And the price we paid for that high social cohesion, I describe in the book, you know, being a field full of people, all of whom are, you know, employed by the state, miners, housed by the state, educated by the state. The price we paid for it was hierarchy, you know, with all the things. I was brought up a Catholic, so all the problems of the Catholic Church in the 1960s in terms of abuse, violence, the rest of it, we paid a high price for that society. We can't go back to it, but I want us to go forward to something better than this, because, you know, until 2008, you know, my background as an economics reporter, I heard people saying there's nothing better than a free market society with high atomization, individualism, but it's going to get better year on year. After 2008, it was, there's nothing better than this, but it's going to get worse year on year. And this is causing severe dislocation, I think, in politics and in social life.
Now, you lay a lot of the blame for the ills of society in the world at the door of neoliberalism, which I think began, you say, in about 1979. That's a global model of capitalism, which you say is falling apart.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people on the right of politics don't like the word of neoliberalism because they think it's a catch-all insult. Now, for me, it's a description of a thing with a beginning and a middle and an end. It was a period of fairly high growth, fueled by borrowing, and you found out here in Ireland during the euro crisis what the negative side of that can be. But its real overhead cost was what it did to the human self. It made us into these two-dimensional, transactional individuals focused on, you know, the philosopher Foucault calls us entrepreneurs of the self. Everything's on you. But the price you pay for that is you become eminently governable. You become able to be pushed around, first of all, by the economic forces. Now we find, you know, there's a great craving for strong men, strong politicians who will break the rules. And my fear about the future is that this is like an entry-level drug for the machine control of human beings, for the artificial intelligence and the algorithms to start pushing us around like pawns on a playing
board. We'll come on to that, but I suppose maybe the economic sibling of neoliberalism might be globalization.
Absolutely.
And you wrote and you talk about this in a chapter which is the book, needless to say, is beautifully written.
Thank you.
But you have a general theory of Trump, and you recall that you wrote within hours of Trump's election, globalization is dead, the American superpower will die. A lot of people would like to think you were right about that, but maybe you can't be so sure.
I want to defend globalisation by doing less of it and by doing it more justly. What does that mean? You remember this TTIP treaty that was defeated, that Obama wanted to bring in? I'm glad that was defeated. If we can bring in more sovereignty to nation states within the European Union, where that they control their own labour market, they control the lots of things that we want to be able to do to restrict what sort of rack-renting landlords and red-in-tooth-and-claw capitalism can do, I'll be happy, but I don't want us to go back to a situation which is what I think both Trump and Putin want, which is the end of the world order, the end of multilateral commitments, so that everything now is down to naked power. So, yeah, I think that we defend globalisation by stepping back a bit from it, and it, absolutely, you know, globalization has been good for the bottom half of the world population because it's, I mean, when I say good, I mean, I'm always reminded by, I think, people who are fascinated by this and love it, that, you know, of the slums I've been in the developing world and in the sweatshops, it raised people from $1 a day to $2, but that's still quite horrible. But for people in the developed world, there's just a crisis of belief that this can actually work for us. And I understand what is driving, because, of course, I'm reporting like you
are.
Yeah,
but hasn't it swept away, hasn't it globalization swept away millions of jobs, say, in manufacturing? It partly responsible for what led to the triumph of Trump. He promised things would be different in the Midwest. Now, whether they are or will be is another story. And similarly, the old style, if you like, the smokestack industries.
And look, about half. I think a rule of thumb is about half of all the, you know, low rent, low skill, low value jobs creation that we've lived through in the Western world is to do with offshoring, and about half is to do with technological change, progress, automation. I want a world where we take advantage of the automation. So I think there's many people on the left walking around talking about everybody will have a decent job. I just don't think this is going to be true in the 20th century. I don't, you know, when Trump talks about bringing the jobs back to America, if those factories came back to America, they'd be staffed by robots. I've seen them, I've been in them. You know, a modern automobile factory has very, very few workers. The reason they have a lot of workers in Mexico or Costa Rica is because labor's cheap. Now, I think that my utopia that I want to convince other progressives and left-wing people, I'm on the left, and I regard the left as a broad church, I want to convince them of a utopia beyond work and beyond the hierarchies and necessities of the last 200 years of industrial society. And it's that kind of politics, rather than a retreat back to, as it were, to the world of my granddad, that I think the left has to embrace.
And part of that, obviously, in your view, means taking control of those great technological forces, which, I mean, you talk about what's planned, for instance, by the Chinese authorities in terms of how they will control people, I suppose, just literally get into the palm of their hand.
They have commissioned in the mid-2020s a social insurance scheme, a social credit scheme that would judge all your behaviour that the state can record. Do you jump a red light? Were you late for work? Have you committed a minor offence? Criminality? All gets put into one place and it affects your life chance. And if you think that's, you know, dystopian, but in China, you know, albeit it's a long way, it's still not Europe. There are now, I think, 18 countries importing Chinese-made surveillance and population control technologies. That Ireland is not one of them. Kenya, Pakistan, Uzbekistan. This is where it's going, and I think that we are right to fear it. And if we want to, we want to demand control and autonomy from it, you've got to have a theory of human beings on whose behalf you're demanding control.
By way of an aside, and maybe it's not an aside, maybe Trump is right about Huawei.
Well, look, whether Trump's right about Huawei, reminding the listeners, this is the huge Chinese innovative 5G telecoms provider that's being banned progressively from all the kind of Five Eyes, they call them, the big NATO powers. I don't want to see it on the current terms in Britain's infrastructure, simply because our own spies, our own security experts say it's not safe. They can't de-risk it. Now, however, I want the Western world to engage positively with China and Russia, and almost like as equals, and say, what is it actually, guys, that you want? I'm not into the anti-Chinese saber-rattling. I've been there. I've been there more times than any other country, and I think that we need to kind of develop a mature and mutually respectful relationship.
But the question question is, I mean, how do we get control, I mean, we as world citizens, if you like, of the great big forces of technology, because they are, by definition, global.
Yep.
And who's to take control of them?
I don't think they're global anymore. It's sad, but, you know, China has created a great wall of great firewall, as they say, around itself. You can't do Facebook, Google and Twitter properly in China. Now, in response, what today Trump, this executive order against Huawei that Trump issued has resulted in the fact that now Google is not going to update its software on Huawei phones. Now, you know, lots of people have Huawei phones. That's called the balkanization of the internet. And I fear that is coming. Now, to take control of it means where there are democracies, the democracies have to think, I think, fairly aggressively about the big tech companies. Never mind Huawei, think about Facebook and Google and Amazon, some of them based right here. We'll have to break them up. We're going to have to make them less powerful than states.
And maybe get them paying a bit more tax?
Paying tax if it alters the behaviour. More important to me is to say that, you know, when you go to the ATM, you don't have to withdraw, you don't have to go to your own bank's ATM. You can go to it. The ATM is an interface to the banking system. Just in the same way, Facebook could be the interface to 10 different companies providing 10 different services, and I would hope one of them in the competition would be, we don't sell your data to the Russians, we don't let dark advertising from fascists into the lives of you and your children, and I would even pay for that service, to be quite honest.
But coming back to where we started, Paul, you suggest that neoliberalism is on what you call life support.
Well, I think it is. The life support is $16 trillion worth of central bank money.
We've just saved it,
but you can't save, and you can keep an economy on life support, but you cannot keep an ideology on life support, because the human brain demands coherence, and what it wants to know is, how does my child have a better life than me? How does the street of my hometown, Wigan in Lancashire, it's like a zombie movie, to be honest. How does it stop being like that? And until we have an economic system that can answer that, then all the problems I talk about in the book of the far right, the so-called alt-right, the global misogynistic movement that is right now on the offensive, trying to take women's abortion rights away from them, that won't be defeated until we have an economic answer that makes people optimistic about the future.
And what about how this applies in your own country of Britain?
I knew that.
I mean, arguably, the ills which you've described, Brexit was a reaction to a lot of that.
Brexit was a reaction, I think, overwhelmingly to the economic and social impacts in some small-town communities of free movement. That's what it was. You've even had it here. You know, when I've been in the Republic of Ireland, I've even seen similar small towns react similarly badly to, say, Polish or Lithuanian migration. Now, I think we could have stopped it, or Brexit, with a clearer reform project for Europe. And right now, you know, I'm on the left of the Labour Party. I'm part of that Labour Party group that wants to stay in Europe, wants a second referendum. But we're absolutely clear that if we do stay in, we're going to have to fight for a radical reform of the kind of called Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil here just are not interested in. But I do think some of the parties of the European left would be our allies there.
Where, you say you're on the left. I mean, does that make you a Corbynite? And can you explain to us exactly what Corbyn's position is on Brexit? Because it seems to be a bit mercurial.
Can do it in the time available. This book is most definitely not tied to any one party or even figure like Corbyn. I have supported him as a Labour member because I wanted to break the stranglehold on our party of what to hedge funds, bankers, accountancy firms, and get it into the hands of the
people. Isn't he the biggest reason why Labour probably won't get elected, even though they should get elected, based on all the kind of criteria and expectations, electoral cycle? Is he not the biggest single obstacle?
He's certainly a Marmite politician, and I campaign for him on the doorstep, and I can see, you know, paradoxically, over an issue that will be very up front of mind for your own listeners, especially the same age as me, over Ireland. You know, the British electorate still, I would regard quite reactionary views over the Irish national question. But, you know, Corbyn, I think, is a stage to the recomposition of a British left that can represent the progressive half of, and it's more than half, and the future, the young generation. And so for me, support for him has always been, you know, tactical, contingent, and in the future, I think there'll be a bigger and wider and more progressive project.
How do you see the Brexit situation being settled? Or, you know, where's it going to end?
I'm afraid...
Will it end with Brexit?
I think, well... I think it's 50-50. I think the next stage will be Boris Johnson taking over the Conservative Party. I'm afraid to tell you, and I think your T-shirt, I know it was the Tanishu said yesterday, it won't change anything. I think it will. I think he's going to go for a no deal on the 31st of October. He doesn't even need a parliamentary majority for that. It just happens. And from that no deal, though, I think and the only way of stopping that is to trigger a general election. And I think that, so it's no, it's like in one of those poker games where there's just two players left. It's Corbyn and Johnson. You may not like either of them, but it is their politics that will decide the outcome of Brexit.
As we say around here, it'll shorten the winter. Paul Mason, thank you so much indeed for coming to studio. That is, the book is called Clear Bright Future, A Radical Defence of the Human Being, published by Alan Lane. And a reminder, Paul is speaking tonight at Smock Alley Theatre as part of the Dublin Literature Festival. Some tickets left on ilfdublin.com, ilfdublin.com.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.